Greg, look at this email I just got.
My dear, I am Barrister Musa Issa, the solicitor counsel to the late Vera Sidorova, who was, before time of death, head of state of the Kazakhstan. Just yesterday, a family member called to solicit my humble self to look for a reputable gentleman who will be of great assistance to the family and somebody who can take over the sum of $27 million. Kion, this is just one of those 419 scam letters.
No, it's not, because they always mention Nigeria and this one doesn't.
I think you're focusing on the wrong detail.
I swear, Greg, if it said Nigeria, I would back right off. But in this case, I really think the sensible thing to do is to fly to Kazakhstan, establish residence, maybe, you know, date a little bit, get a feel for the place, and then, you know, make my move on this $27 million.
Really? Is that the most sensible use of your time?
I don't know, because I have no logical framework for decision making. Remember that time when I invested in the elephant dung farm?
How could I forget?
Today, Stephen Dubner tells us how to think like a freak about problems. Frank Rizzo breaks down the Tony Awards. And Andrew Zimbalist teaches a course in sports stadium economics. And now he's starting to think that some of the women on the Tonys were actually men. Colin McEnroe.
Hello, people who listen to this in podcast form, or some other form that would cause you to be hearing my voice right now. So I have some terrible news. Well, it's not that terrible. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not pandemonium terrible. It's not mass hysteria terrible. But we had a problem with our audio servers. It all stems from a very bad decision we made to let Chucky be the weekend engineer this weekend. And it turns out he's just not reliable, even now. Even now, he's still a homicidal toy. So we had a little problem with the audio servers, and we lost the first segment, most of the first segment of the show, which was a fascinating, I hesitate to tell you this, but it was a fascinating conversation with Stephen J. Dubner, who's part of the Freakonomics team. And when I say we lost it, like, we really lost it. I mean, you know, there will be in our post-apocalyptic future puppet shows in which our entire conversation is acted out, but you're probably not going to be around for that. So what we do have are two very interesting segments, one of them with the economist Andrew Zimbalist. That'll be the last one. He specializes in looking at the economics of sports stadiums and sports franchises in general, and obviously that's on the minds of people around Connecticut right now. And then before that, Frank Rizzo, who's the theater critic of the Hartford Current, is going to kind of break down last night's Tony Awards, which also have some pretty profound Connecticut implications. You may know that one of the big winners of the night was a show that was birthed here in Hartford at the Hartford Stage Company. So that's what we've got for you, and maybe a tiny trickle of Stephen J. Dubner. I'm not entirely sure yet. Sorry about that. The main thing I want to say is we love you. We love you, podcast listeners, and we want to provide you with a program that will make you happy, and we hope this does, but it'll only make you two-thirds as happy as we wanted it to, and that causes us great sorrow. Anyway, thanks for listening, and here's what we've got. Reading Think Like a Freak, I was thinking, you know, you could do an entire Broadway show with Stephen J. Dubner, because, I mean, there's some ideas that just on the face of them shouldn't be done. Just you describe them and they shouldn't be done. I mean, musical based on Bridges of Madison County might be one of them. Or, for that matter, musical about the boat building industry by Sting. You know, you just say that and it seems like, you know, it seems like everybody in the room is going, no, we should never do that. But in fact, both of those things are realities. One has come and gone. The other is nigh upon us. But before we even mention anything like that, we're so lucky to have Frank Rizzo, a theater critic for the Hartford Current, and blogging about theater at Behind the Curtain. And so, Frank, this is a happy day in Hartford. I mean, we don't know what AA baseball could ever portend for us, but for a considerably smaller investment, we have national exposure.
Well, first there was the UConn double win in basketball, and now this.
Right.
I mean, if Hartford doesn't take advantage of such high-profile wins, then they're not doing their job.
So explain what you mean by this.
This the winning a Tony Award for a musical is the biggest Broadway honor there is, because it translates to shows and going all around literally the world, and it represents a show that was nurtured and developed and paid for and with a lot of talent from Hartford Stage. The audiences in downtown Hartford were the first ones to really experience what the best show on musical on Broadway is, and it's officially recognized last night at the Tony Awards.
So we're talking about A Gentleman's Guide to Love and
Murder. You're right. The name might be good. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, directed by Hartford Stage's artistic director, Darko Jonick, who won for Best Actor. Best Director in a musical.
And actually, you know, when something like that happens, Frank, you know, when you hear Darko's name get called out, however fuzzily, by Clint Eastwood, who was probably only about 70% sure about where he even was at that moment. But you hear Darko's name and you see him walking up there. And I don't know about you, but I was thinking, I wonder if anybody will know about the Hartford connection here. So, Wolfie, let's get the answer to that question. These are the first words out of his mouth.
I would like to thank my artistic home, Hartford Stage. My husband, Josh. I love you. Robert and Steve and a beautiful cast headed by Jefferson Mays. And I should thank so many people, but most of all, my mom literally taught me how to jump out of airplanes. She fought during the Second World War. She was a skydiver in the 1940s. She's 87 years old, and she's too frail to be here tonight, so I'm going to thank her. So, mama, volim te, hvala ti za sve što si mi dala. Volim te mnogo, drži se. Thank you very much.
So it's a good thing that his frail mother wasn't there, because if she sat in the front row, Neil Patrick Harris might have sat on top of her.
Well, it was such a touching moment. And I talked to Darko right after that. He said accepting the award from Clint Eastwood was a surreal experience, and who can blame him for thinking that? And then what he said to his mother, who is very frail and not doing so well in her home in Maryland, is simply that he loved her. It was all for her. And to just stay well.
You know, Frank, you and I have watched a series of transitions at the Hartford Stage Company, starting with Mark Lamos, who was a hell of a director, still is a hell of a director, replaced by Michael Wilson, a hell of a director, and a guy who really knew how to interface with the community, too. I mean, just, you know, he knew everybody in Hartford, everybody knew him. Now Darko's come along, and I feel like we certainly lost nothing in this transition, and Darko almost seems like more of a crowd. I mean, both of those guys are massive directors. Darko seems like almost more of a crowd pleaser. Though than they were. I mean, watching A Gentleman's Guide when it was playing in Hartford, I walked out in the lobby and I ran into Mike Stotz, who runs the other side, the business side of the Hartford Stage. I said, "This thing's going to New York, right?" I mean, he just seems to have kind of a very nice touch with what an audience is going to love.
He has a great amount of style and taste issues, but Hartford Stage is just extraordinarily lucky to have such a run of special directors who each have brought shows to Broadway and have been nominated for their shows. So the question is, what does this mean? What does this win mean for Hartford Stage and for Hartford to see if this will generate new support for new musicals and new work, which is always, always a tough sell.
What do you think it does mean? I mean, it's early to say. We don't really know whether they'll sell more subscriptions next season, but you have to assume there's a bump. There's some kind of bump. I mean, this has never happened. I think you pointed out today, this hasn't happened since Annie came out of the Goodspeed Opera House.
That's right.
Back in the 1970s for a Best Musical Tony. You got to assume there is a bump at the box office, and as you say, maybe a bump even also in terms of what's possible, what could get funded.
Well, I think it would definitely get a bump at the box office, and it'll also get some cash, because Hartford Stage will be participating in the royalties along with Old Globe Playhouse in San Diego that had the second production of the show prior to Broadway. But what I think it most significantly means is that major funders will be more inclined to throw in major money to support things that no one has ever heard about. Let's not forget that supporting the show to the tune of like $135,000 was the Richard P. Garmany Fund out of the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. That's $135,000, and it got other types of grants like that. Without that, this show could never have happened, and no one in Hartford would be, you know, celebrating tonight. You know, don't forget, Aetna, too, is hugely supported. An unknown playwright called Kiera Alegria Hudas, and for her play Water by the Spoonful, she won a Pulitzer Prize. So Hartford Stage is really on a roll.
I mean, one of the lessons, too, for people is, you know, I always feel this way, too. You should go see Hartford Stage and Theater Works and Long Wharf and Yale Rep and Goodspeed. Go see all these theaters, all the stuff that you can at these theaters, because you also will pay a lot less. I mean, you're going to spend a lot of money going to see that show, Gentleman's Guide. I don't know what, you know, what an orchestra seat is these days for that particular show, but it's not cheap. It's probably three times what it would have cost you to see it at Hartford Stage at least.
Absolutely. But the other thing, too, is, listen, you're going to be the first to see the show that everyone's going to be talking about next year. You're going to have a little cachet saying, have you seen the latest show at whether it be Long Wharf or Westport or Hartford Stage, and especially now that it has such an incredible track record for all of these theaters moving things on. But even if they didn't move anything on, what they're doing is just extraordinary, and it's the highest professional level that is obviously rewarded last night.
So did you get to go to these post parties and stuff
yes,
like that?
Yes, I did.
All right. So, well, pull back the curtain on that. We want to know what's going on behind the curtain at these parties.
Well, the Gentleman's Guide party was at the 30 Rock at the outdoor restaurant, the Summer Garden restaurant, which is literally over the skating rink. So the crowd was dancing and celebrating beneath the gilded bronze statue of Prometheus. The DJ was playing Pharrell Williams' Happy, and you've never seen a happier crowd in a long, long time.
I thought it was a fairly interesting telecast last night. Although, I mean, I think I prefer Neil Patrick Harris as host of the Tonys to Hugh Jackman. I mean, Hugh Jackman's really good, and I mean, you don't lose that much dropping down to him.
Yeah, I could have done without the hopping.
The hopping at the beginning.
That didn't work for me. I didn't get it.
But in general, I mean, it certainly is the best award show to watch because these people can actually do things.
It is, and you really get a taste of it. Of course, the plays sort of get shortchanged. That's been a perennial dilemma of how to present non-musical work. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, it gives audiences from around the country that, of course, will never see a Broadway show, but have a sense that this is part of our American culture.
Now, so last night we had A Gentleman's Guide winning Best Musical, Darko wins Best Director. I think also there was a Best Script and a Best Costume.
And a Best Costume.
Yeah. So, and lost out on the score to Jason Robert Brown from British Bridges of Madison County, although I can put a Connecticut tie-in on that. I may be handing you a blog post or something in doing this, which is that David Golub, who is considered by many people to be the best lawyer in Connecticut, has been involved in lots and lots of massive landmark cases. He and his brother, who I believe is a rabbi, they are producers of Broadway shows. And in fact, I think they were among the producers for the Durang comedy that's playing at Hartford Stage Company right now. So they were among the producers of Bridges of Madison County. So there's a Connecticut tie-in even for that one.
Well, there's a Connecticut tie-in because Jason Robert Brown developed his Broadway show 13 at Goodspeed's Second Theater, the Norma Terrace in Chester.
And his other show just ran at the Long Wharf, too. I think it might be.
That's right. Bridges of Madison County was a lovely, lovely show. I saw it when it premiered at the Williamstown Theater Festival last year, and it was a terrific show, too.
So the other Connecticut tie-in, Frank Rizzo, was Anika Noni Rose. She was among the nominees for a featured actor in a play for Raisin in the Sun. Well, they called out the name of the right player, but not the name of the right actress.
Well, didn't she look terrific, too?
She did look great.
Oh.
And so she's from Bloomfield. Her father, I believe, was corporation counsel for the city
and
of Hartford.
She keeps on coming back to Hartford. She's very connected to Charter Oak and so many other activities in Hartford. So she's a local gal who still is connected to her roots.
And she and Jason Robert Brown have collaborated on some performances, too. I think he's done a thing where he'll showcase some of his music, just her and him and a piano or something like that.
Yeah, Anika's really the go-to girl for a lot of these things.
Yeah. So she's and she's a huge talent, and she will win a Tony, I think, someday.
Well, she already won a Tony.
She already has a Tony.
Caroline or Change.
Oh, that's right. Caroline or Change. Absolutely. All
right, and her voice is extraordinary. No, she's, you know, she's. I want to see her in another musical. I mean, she's terrific in A Raisin in the Sun, but, you know, that gal can sing.
All right, Frank Rizzo, great to talk to you. Read more of Frank Rizzo in the Hartford Current or go to the blog, which is part of the Hartford Current, Behind the Curtain. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Andrew Zimbalist. He is the god of stadium economics.
I want me a trophy. I want a trophy. Trophy, I want me a trophy. A trophy. I want me a
trophy. I'm checking Ticketmaster right now for tickets to the new Sting Broadway musical, and it says I can have any seat at any performance. Should I be worried? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Lily Tyson and Allison Ehrenreich. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Clint Eastwood. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff performing a musical number from the fridges of Madison County, visit WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, why are Canadians so darn funny? And now, back to Colin.
I just like the topic of tomorrow's show. I like even hearing it said. That's how great a topic it is. All right. So we're going to talk stadium economics here. Jeff Cohen is here in the studio with us. He's the ace newsman for WNPR who's been doing the deep dive into the numbers on the Hartford Stadium. It's a tough day for Jeff because the last night at the Tonys, Eva and Sadie and the worst haircut ever, the musical did not do well. I think casting Taylor Swift as Sadie was a big mistake.
It was rough.
She did not own that part. And so as you probably know, there's a proposal to move the New Britain Rockettes, a AA baseball team, to Hartford and to make them happy by building a very modern stadium for them. The top number on the stadium would be $60 million. You know, there's always the possibility they'll just give a lot of it back, you know, and not use it all. But that doesn't happen all that often. So Jeff's got the numbers here. Joining us is Andrew Zimbalist, who is the Robert A. Woods Professor of Economics at Smith College. He's written extensively on the business of sports and for a long time, so long that I first became aware of his work back in the 1990s when we were going through a huge convulsion here about the notion of building a much bigger and more expensive stadium for the New England Patriots, who turned out not to be coming. He's the author of several books, including his most recent, The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball. So, Andrew Zimbalist, let's just sort of begin with the general idea of improving a struggling city through the relocation of a professional sports team. We can get specific about minor league baseball if you want, but just for starters, my sense is reading your work and then the work that your work has spawned, I think this much larger academic network of economists who are doing similar kinds of things these days. You know, I mean, if there's two rules, it seems like one of them is it usually costs more than everybody thinks it's going to cost, and it usually generates less revenue than everybody's claiming. It's gonna, but feel free to disagree with me about this. You're the expert.
No, Colin, it sounds like you don't even need me. You got it all down. there have been studies now for the last 25 years looking statistically at what happens to a city when it introduces a professional ball team into the city and or builds an arena or stadium in the city. And what those studies have uniformly found, uniformly, I underscore, because economists rarely agree with each other, is that a stadium by itself or an arena by itself is not an engine of economic development, which is to say that it does not generate net jobs and it does not raise per capita income. Now, that conclusion, which has, as I say, appeared in all sorts of studies, is in fact a generalization. It's kind of an average over all of the cases. There can be individual cases where if the financing of the stadium is propitious for the city, if it's favorable for the city, if the city has certain development characteristics and locational opportunities then and there's a reasonably good lease, then it's possible that there could be a net modest and net positive increase in employment from the stadium. On the other hand, if those factors are not present and they lean the other way against the city's interest, then it could be a negative influence. But on average, the idea of building a stadium by itself or an arena by itself as a development tool is not a good idea. It doesn't pay off. So what's been happening over the last 10 years, more or less, is that especially in these days of fiscal stringency, when no government body seems to have any money, is that cities have been leaning on the team owners to say, look, if you want to have a partnership here and you want us to help you out with land and also with financing, we want you to commit to developing the area around the stadium. That is to say, we want you to, if you're talking about, oh, the stadium is an iconic magnet for activity, well, so why don't you commit, find some investors and commit to build some residential property there, or commit to build commercial property, or commit to build retail property. There are some examples where you have that larger development plan involving not just the stadium but also other investments. In those circumstances, and we have several examples of them, it can be an engine of development. But a stadium by itself doesn't work.
Jeff Cohen, you really have been making a massive effort to sort of at least understand the numbers that we're being given. And none of the things that Andrew Zimbalist just talked about have been proposed. In fact, the Solomon brothers, Solomon siblings, who are the owners of this team, would have some skin in the game in terms of maybe 10% of the cost of the stadium. But tell us what else you found out about the numbers. It may be interesting for Andrew Zimbalist to react to.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of financial projections that come out of this because the mayor really is selling this, Mayor Segarra in Hartford really is selling this as economic development. So an estimated $2 million in annual tax revenue, an annual estimated, and that's not to the city, by the way, that would be to the state, an annual estimated $8 million in hotel, food, and beverage spending, 600 new full-time permanent jobs, 900 initial construction jobs. Now, leaving the construction jobs aside, there's one number that's really paramount in all of this, and that's the annual average attendance that they're projecting. 500,000 people would have to come to the baseball events alone. That's a big deal, because if you divide that by the number of games that the baseball team has in a year, it's about at home games, that's about 7,000 people per game. The Rockcats right now get 3,800 people per game on average this year. So the financial projections are all based on that average attendance, which left me at least scratching my head.
Well, Andrew Zimbalist, one of the things that it does seem is that it's pretty easy to find a consultant who will do a PowerPoint presentation for a city going into some kind of partnership of this kind with some sports owners that will paint this kind of blue sky scenario. I mean, Jeff's done a lot of other research about the fact that they're proposing that 10% of the people who go to these games roughly will stay in hotels, which just doesn't really fit with my understanding of people going to AA baseball games. They're assessing the catchment area for this stadium as 2.5 million people, which is almost the entire state of Connecticut. So, I mean, it just seems as though it's I guess there's no penalty ever assessed to any feasibility consultant for coming up with these blue sky numbers.
On the contrary, if they come up with gray sky numbers, they'll never get hired again. No, it's absolutely the case. I think universally for every single minor league, major league, and college stadium that's been built over the last 30 years, there's a consultant group that's hired. They do an input-output study, uses a model that's usually called REMI, R-E-M-I. That methodology is inappropriate for this purpose, and they make unrealistic assumptions. Just one of them you suggested about 10% hotel stays, which does indeed sound unrealistic. But you can generate. Why stop at 600 jobs? Why not say 10,000 jobs? It doesn't make any sense. If I were given the study, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure that I could go through it page by page and sentence by sentence and show you what doesn't work. But look, the idea that you're going to generate $2 million of tax revenue to the state by moving a baseball team from New Britain to Hartford, the only way that something like that could even begin to happen is if you got a lot of people coming from Massachusetts and Rhode Island and New York and wherever else, traveling long distances that people don't travel for a double-A team, especially if you're in New England and the team is based, the home team is based in Minnesota, I don't think you're going to get any tax revenue, because all you're doing is either you're transferring spending in New Britain to spending in Hartford, or you're transferring money that is spent on other entertainment venues in Greater Hartford towards spending at the new ballpark. That's what tends to happen. But in the process, the city or the state is taking on $60 million or more in debt. I don't know. These things always have cost overruns. I don't know what kind of provisions are in there right now. But, 10, 20, 30, 40% cost overruns are very common. But if you use a figure of $60 million and you assume that the interest rate is going to be roughly 4%, you're talking about $3.8 million steady state cost in financing that debt service over the years. That doesn't help the economy. That by itself hurts the economy. So any gain that's made during the construction period where you have construction workers, that gets offset by payments that have to be made over time. Roughly $3.8 million a year. I'm saying that very generally. Yeah. It could be a little more or less.
Let me just jump in here, because we're about to run out of time. There's one thing I want to get to. So maybe it's a $60 million debt, but one of the other possibilities, Jeff, is that some of that money, maybe $20 million, they may be raiding a cookie jar elsewhere in the budget and actually pulling that out as a capital expenditure, right?
That's right. They've looked to do that, to isolate some projects on the city's capital improvement project list from projects that have already been approved. And the mayor hasn't yet decided which projects will come off that list.
Those are jobs that will be lost then. If there are other capital improvement projects that aren't going to happen, those are lost jobs.
And Andrew Zimbalist, one thing I wanted to ask you is, I don't know whether anybody's done this, but one of the questions that I have about a project like this is whether it's debt service money or whether it's money from raiding the cookie jar of the budget. It invariably means that other things don't get done in a municipality that commits a lot of money to a project like this. I don't know if anybody's ever sort of tried to study that. Like, what's the effect of the urban park that doesn't get fixed up, or the school that doesn't get repaired, or this money, is going to go someplace else now.
Yeah. So and what you have to do is to compare the development prospects of investing in roads, or investing in security, or investing in a public park versus investing in a new ballpark for a double-A ball team. Because it's the same money, it's the same $2 million or $20 million or $60 million being spent on one item instead of being spent on another item. And, another issue that has to be emphasized here is we're talking about a ballpark that's going to be used 72 games out of a year. That's one out of every 5 days, a little less than one out of every 5 days. Some of the other projects, if you build roads, they're going to be used every day of the year.
Yeah. All right. Well, Andrew Zimbalist, we are out of time. Thanks so much for your time, though. Andrew Zimbalist is the Robert A. Woods Professor of Economics at Smith. His most recent book is The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball. Jeff Cohen is ace reporter for WNPR, the guy who's been covering this story and also covering the Hartford City budget, which now kind of interlocked in an interesting way. All right. We'll be back tomorrow with a very interesting show about why are Canadians so darn funny, eh?
Whisper, go, go, go. Just for certain, no, no, no. Did you know that if you build it, they could come?
I'm Kyle Wolf with a proposal to shut this whole ballpark idea down. Instead, we're going to build a factory that makes solar-powered umbrellas. Okay, all right, fine. We'll take Hartford resident Jamil Ragland up on his idea for a giant pyramid. Really? Okay.